From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nicola Grisco with the news on this Tuesday, August 20th, 2024.
This Day in Maine is made possible by Now You're Cooking, celebrating 24 years of selling cookware, kitchen tools, gadgets, and fine wine on historic Front Street in downtown Bath, open 7 days a week.
After hearing from dozens of witnesses and reviewing thousands of pages of documents, the independent commission investigating the mass shootings in Lewiston last October has concluded its work without making any formal policy recommendations. In their final report, commissioners say they hope the facts they've uncovered will help prevent a similar tragedy in the future. But as Susan Sharon reports, accountability is most likely to come from civil litigation brought on behalf of victims and survivors.
As they did in their interim report, commissioners find fault with the Sagadahoc County Sheriff's Office for failing to take the gunman Robert Card into protective custody and to take away his firearms under Maine's yellow flag law. They also criticized leaders of Card's Army Reserve Unit for failing to take steps to reduce the threat he posed to the public. The final report notes that his commanding officers were, quote, aware of his auditory hallucinations, increasingly aggressive behavior, collection of guns, and ominous comments about his intentions. And yet, they didn't share what they knew with the sheriff's office, and they ignored recommendations from Card's mental health providers to ensure that his weapons were removed.
We will never know if he might still have committed a mass shooting, even if someone had managed to remove his firearms before October 25th.
Former Supreme Court Chief Justice Daniel Wathen is the commission's chair, who says Robert Card is solely responsible for killing 18 people at a bowling alley and a bar about 4 miles apart.
But the commission unanimously finds that there were several opportunities that, if taken, might have changed the course of these tragic events.
Largely spared from criticism in the report is the private psychiatric hospital that released Card less than 3 months before he carried out his deadly attacks, and the mental health providers who were responsible for his follow-up care. Card was discharged a day after the cancellation of a court hearing to consider his involuntary commitment. According to the report, he was progressing in treatment, had agreed to continue taking his medications, and to participate in therapy. His treating psychiatrist, quote, did not feel that the hospital would be successful in court. But between August 3rd and October 25th, Card engaged in no treatment, took almost none of his prescribed medications, and did not answer or return calls or emails from treatment providers. Card's case with the hospital was then closed due to his noncompliance. The report is silent on whether that response was appropriate.
I'm sure there will be civil litigation, which will draw a finer point on that.
For now, Wathen says Card's discharge and follow-up treatment speaks for itself. Attorneys representing victims and survivors of the shootings say they appreciate the facts gathered by the commission. What's clear, says attorney Ben Gideon, is that someone with a diagnosed psychosis, who also possesses numerous assault weapons, requires action.
There's not much of a debate in this country about whether folks who have diagnosed mental health illness and have expressed the desire to commit violence should continue to possess weapons of warfare, as occurred here. That shouldn't happen, it shouldn't have happened here, and it should never be allowed to happen again.
Gideon says other missed opportunities for action include efforts by Card's sister, who repeatedly tried to speak to his Army Reserve leaders and never got a return phone call in April and May. Her conversation with a VA crisis worker, who told her that her brother's delusions of being called a pedophile could harm his career, and her ongoing frustration in finding ways to help him. They also include the Army's failure to confront Card about his behavior when he showed up for drills in April, and ultimately his release into the community from the hospital with no plan to deal with his psychosis, his ongoing paranoia, and his access to firearms.
The next step in this process needs to be real accountability, and that's where we come in. And in the next few months, you will be hearing what that plan entails, in terms of the civil lawsuits and cases that we will be pursuing on behalf of all of our clients.
Speaking through an interpreter, Megan Vozella, whose husband Steve was killed in the shootings, says more accountability is needed, including better communication access for the deaf community. Four of the people killed were deaf. Their friends and family members struggled to get information that night.
I want to see policies for police departments about communication access. I want the military to improve their access needs for mental health. And I think it's really important, especially for their health needs. People are crying out for help and they're not getting it. And the result is that they harm innocent people in innocent communities.
One specific suggestion included in the report is that Maine State Police undergo an independent after-action review about its massive response to the mass shootings, described as utter chaos in the first hours after hundreds of law enforcement officers descended on Lewiston. Commission Chair Daniel Wathen says that will allow for policy, protocol, and other policing improvements. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And in other news, over 1,600 gallons of firefighting foam containing dangerous PFAS chemicals were accidentally discharged at a former naval air base in Brunswick. The incident occurred yesterday morning after the fire suppression system for one of the hangars was discharged, with some of the foam escaping through stormwater systems. The firefighting foam AFFF contains PFAS chemicals that smother jet fuel fires. Professor Matthew Klingel, an environmental historian at nearby Bowdoin College and the director for the Environmental Studies Program, says the chemicals are linked to serious health risks and are nearly indestructible in nature.
To me, the bigger concern is not the immediate cleanup, but the fact that this is going to add to the already not insignificant amount of PFAS and other dangerous chemicals that are in the soils and the waters.
The former naval air base now functions as the Brunswick Executive Airport. Maine restricted the use of AFFF back in 2021. Public documents show the Navy had planned to remove the foam from the hangar by October. The Maine CDC has identified Eastern Equine Encephalitis in a wild turkey in Burnham. It's the first animal in the state to test positive for triple E this year. The agency says this is the earliest in the year that three mosquito-borne viruses have been detected in the state. West Nile virus has been found in 15 birds, and Jamestown Canyon virus has been found in four mosquito pools. The diseases can cause serious health issues in humans, including brain swelling and meningitis. State health officials urge people to take precautions to prevent mosquito bites. And Northern Light Health is no longer using a potent greenhouse gas as a surgical anesthetic in an effort to reduce the organization's contribution to climate change. The hospital company eliminated dusfluorine from its operating rooms as of August 1st. The gas is widely used in surgery, but sustainability officer Tim Doak says it's a more harmful greenhouse pollutant than carbon dioxide or methane.
Take a given unit of dusfluorine and compare it with CO2, and you would find that dusfluorine is about 2,500 times worse.
Northern Light says it uses less polluting options for general anesthesia. It says it is the first hospital network in Maine to stop using dusfluorine. And the University of Maine system will study the feasibility of establishing a public medical school in the state. The system says it's working with a Missouri-based consulting firm to determine whether a public medical school is needed in Penobscot County to help address a workforce shortage. Maine lawmakers approved funding for the study last year. A report and recommendations are due to the legislature in November 2025. And Maine's Passenger Rail Authority wants to build a new Portland station off of St. John Street. Erwin Gratz reports.
Three sites were considered. The desired location is across from the Greater Portland Metro bus garage. More importantly, it's along the track Downeaster trains use on their journey from Boston to Brunswick. Currently, trains have to exit that track onto a spur that leads to the Portland Transportation Center on Thompson's Point. Officials say doing that, then backing trains onto the main line, cost riders an extra 15 minutes. Preliminary designs show a two-platform design and parking for about 100 cars. still to be determined what, if any, properties the Rail Authority will need to acquire on St. John Street and where the funding for the station will come from. Erwin Gratz, Maine Public Radio News.
And also in Portland, city councilors voted unanimously last night to approve new regulations on short-term rentals. Non-owner-occupied rentals in Portland were previously capped at 400. Under the new rules, the city will reduce the cap to about 285 units, or about 1.5% of Portland's long-term housing stock. Councilor Kate Sykes says the new rules are intended to prevent investors from scooping up homes that could otherwise serve as long-term rental housing.
So as the number of long-term rentals increases in the city, hopefully we're going to build a lot more housing. And if we do, we can have more short-term rentals.
Many owners say that they maintain short-term rentals as a way to supplement their own income and that they rent units to tourists who otherwise couldn't afford to stay in a Portland hotel. Existing operators will keep their licenses under the new rules, but the city will not approve new permits until the number of non-owner-occupied units in Portland falls below the new cap. And two changes to Portland's minimum wage were also rejected by city councilors last night. One measure would have raised the city's minimum wage from $15 to $20 an hour over the next 4 years. Another proposal would have eliminated the tip credit for restaurant workers, which Portland residents voted down 2 years ago. Neither measure will be on the November ballot. Several restaurant workers spoke in opposition against the tip credit proposal and argued that it should be up to individual businesses to determine how best to pay their employees. Portland residents will vote on a separate initiative in November, which would limit the use of the city's emergency minimum wage to instances when the city council declares a state of emergency and not the state of Maine. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, the latest on veterinary care and how to keep your pets safe and healthy throughout the season. I'm Nicola Grisco. Thanks for listening.